This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The aggressive display of violence seen by right-wing fascist groups in Charlottesville, Virginia, has provoked some serious questioning in the U.S. Scenes from the Unite the Right rally over the weekend seem to be a form of deja vu emerging from the era of Jim Crow racism and Nazi Germany. But should it really surprise us that when the person who overtly courted white supremacist groups is now in the White House, his base will feel emboldened? Unfortunately, the left seems to be struggling to make sense of what has happened, especially when white supremacist violence is cast simply as an issue of free speech, with the likes of the ACLU coming to its defense. The tactics of violent responses to the fascists versus traditional nonviolence has also consumed many progressives. So we're going to get into these issues now with my guest, Melissa Figueroa. She's a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley and was a press director for the Stein-Baraka 2016 presidential campaign with the Green Party and also executive producer of the Green News Network. Her experiences in progressive media include over a decade as a staff producer for the Pacifica Radio Network and lead researcher for the 2005 documentary Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. She's been a print contributor to truthdig.com, Against the Grain, and New Politics, and a longtime political educator and organizer involved in a wide range of movements for social and environmental justice in California. She's also part of the newly forming Campus Anti-Fascist Network, and she's a correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Melissa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So this idea that the incidents in Charlottesville came seemingly out of nowhere is definitely something that I know you and others are, you know, not happy about, because you have been warning that these movements that showed up in places like Berkeley when Milo Yiannopoulos's speech was set to happen, that these are groups that aren't backing down, right? We shouldn't have been surprised by Charlottesville, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is a something that is a coordinated attempt to flyer white nationalist and fascist propaganda on over 100 college campuses around the nation. And, you know, a lot of times what the media will do is kind of the corporate media, shall we say, but also, you know, I think left media and progressive media have been very slow to catch on in that they treat these as isolated incidents. In fact, there have been multiple college attacks. There has been a chilling effect actually on free speech of academics. The recent incident where Kianga Yamhata Taylor had to cancel speaking tours because of alt-right intimidation, or shall we say alt-Reich intimidation and harassment. Same thing with Linda Sarsour, Steven Salaida. Many, many academics are now concerned that the that right-wing intimidation is contributing to actually the loss of academic freedom within universities and the radicalization and of white youth and fascist organizing among students on college campuses.
Now, Melissa, when the clashes, let's put it that way, in Berkeley took place earlier this year after Milo Yiannopoulos's speech was set to take place, there was a narrative about, well, we even if we don't agree with the likes of Mr. Yiannopoulos, we should respect, we should allow him to speak, because when you start silencing people who you disagree with, you risk being silenced yourself. This is part of the justification for why the ACLU is coming to the defense of some of these fascist groups being able to rally in Charlottesville. Where do you stand on this issue, you know, and on this framing that this is a free speech issue?
So, I mean, of course, you know, as an advocate of free speech myself, and as somebody who has militated against the you know, against the silencing of free speech when it comes to social justice issues, it is a tricky one because, again, you know, we do, free speech is a, you know, a pillar of democracy, while at the same time, this particular use of the free speech narrative is being manipulated actually to silence dissent. What I have been saying is that, you know, these claims to free speech by white supremacist and fascist groups cannot be taken outside of the context of violent intimidation, harassment, illegal stalking through doxing, basically the release of people's personal information for the troll armies to, bombard email inboxes. Sonali, I know you've gotten some yourself. It cannot be taken out of the context of the violent intimidation in which, this quote unquote free speech is taking place. Campus appearances, by Milo Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, and others are Trojan horses for the forces of the fascist right to come onto campuses in the case of the February event of Milo's, to out undocumented students and make them vulnerable to ICE raids and deportation on a sanctuary campus and other things. And the campus administrations have done nothing about it.
Is it important for us to sort of look at the kind of free speech that these right-wing fascists are using as insightful speech? Because we know, for example, that courts have ruled it's not legal to go into a crowded theater and yell fire when there is no fire. Should we be looking at it in that way, that when speech is being used to actively incite violence against humans, that we should look at it in a different way?
Absolutely. I mean, incitement is absolutely... Look, there's a fire raging right now. There have been attacks, politically motivated attacks on college campuses. Almost nobody remembers, and this is so frustrating, that an anti-fascist protester was shot on the University of Washington campus in January. I grieve that, Heather Heyer had to die in Charlottesville for people to actually wake up to the fact that this is not about free speech. This is about intimidation. It is about violence. And it is about a very intentional and coordinated fascist play for power. And we're talking not just political power, which they know they have an opening in the form of the Trump administration, but also a cultural push for power, a cultural power in society. As Andrew Breitbart actually said at one point, politics is downstream from culture. And this is definitely a maxim that the fascists have taken to heart. Mm-hmm. Just this morning, if we want to talk about, sort of the relationship between free speech and violence and the manipulative framing that the right is taking on this, Peter Teft, who was a Charlottesville, he was at the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, who has now been disowned by his father. His father revealed to this morning that when confronted with the issue, this is what his father quoted his own son as saying. The thing about us fascists is that we don't believe in freedom of speech. The thing about us fascists is it's not that we don't believe in freedom of speech. You can say whatever you want. We'll just throw you in an oven.
Wow.
So,
I mean, if there isn't there couldn't be a stronger invocation of Nazi genocidal violence than that.
Absolutely. And if you look on the internet spaces of the fascists, they talk quite openly about attacking people at rallies, about bringing guns, discussing, encouraging school shooters to come on campus. It's very violent. And again, this kind of categorical and defense of an abstract principle of free speech obscures the concrete fact that people are being targeted, attacked, marked for death.
And of course, while all of that is happening, you have the occupant of the White House essentially saying, I'm cool with it. In his remarks about what happened in Charlottesville, Trump, said that he blamed the extremism and bigotry on all sides. And the Daily Stormer, which is the Nazi website organizing hub, was so happy with his response. I mean, they were really thrilled. They said that there was virtually no counter signaling of us does at all. He implied that Antifa are haters. We'll talk about who Antifa is in a little bit. He said he loves us all, also refused to answer a question about white nationalists supporting him. No condemnation at all. I mean, that is the perfect measure of Donald Trump's signaling to white supremacists that they are welcome to unleash their violence against, you know, people of color and all those who love and tolerate them.
Absolutely. Arthur Rosenberg, in his essay Fascism as a Mass Movement, which was written in 1934 Germany after Hitler had taken power, which really chronicles the social conditions and the process that led up to the rise of fascism in Germany and Italy. You know, a lot of people will talk about fascism in terms of the black shirts, and not many people will actually discuss fascism in terms of the complicity of the good Germans. You know, it's a really, really strange day when people like Ted Cruz and Orrin Hatch actually are more on point than a lot of people who would consider themselves liberals, who then are standing up for the free speech of fascists in this particular instance. You know, there.
Right. Trump has received a lot of pushback from colleagues in his own party who were a little bit appalled that he didn't just simply come out and name, call out the fascists as fascists, because that's what the fascists are calling themselves, right? They're literally using the term fascists to describe themselves. This is not you and I simply labeling them fascists because of their tactics. They are labeling themselves fascists.
Absolutely. And this is also where I think we need to make a distinction, especially in this moment of economic crisis and uncertainty, that we need to separate out what Nazis actually stood for, which is national socialism, versus the universalist, internationalist ideology of socialism. What I am seeing is a lot of sort of infiltration into progressive circles, even especially like sort of centering around the term, like the conditions of race. There are many people who will argue that it is class is primary and that race is secondary, or it's not as, you know, it's sort of like not as important an issue as uniting people over class. And this is a very dangerous, sort of trend that I'm seeing in even progressive circles, in which, you know, again, what national socialism is a redistributive ideology. It's about taking care of your own, but it's also about drawing a circle around that community that you consider to be your nation or really what human beings are, right?
And so socialism just for us, nationalist socialism, basically.
Exactly. And then, of course, excluding all the undesirables, not just people of color, but disabled people, gay people, trans people, anyone who doesn't fit, again, the master race.
And we saw a lot of even liberal leaders in the past taking advantage of this strain among Americans to undo the social welfare safety net in this country, right? Bill Clinton was able to decimate welfare because he built on this notion that it was black women who were the primary recipients of welfare, when in fact, of course, it wasn't. So there's a long arc in this country, right? That's another thing I want to talk to you about, Melissa. We seem surprised. We want to simply link it to Donald Trump. But in reality, these white supremacy ebbs and flows and has never really gone away in the U.S.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's also, you know, some narratives that are trying to put Trump at the head of this as if he's some kind of mastermind. I mean, you know, in my read, this is basically, the right is taking, is being very opportunistic on this in terms of the fact that Trump and his rhetoric and the rhetoric that got him elected has provided an opening in society for these groups to begin operating and organizing openly. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, making this distinction and not making it just about Trump is very important. These are forces that have been around for a long time, but they have become enabled and emboldened by the political situation in this country on the national level.
Now, Melissa, I understand that the fascists are spreading the hate. They have plans to, since, of course, it started in this year, one of the earliest instances was in Berkeley, where you were. It's coming to Charlottesville twice, actually, this summer at Charlottesville. They're promising to go to Florida, back to Berkeley. So in light of the fact that the fascists have decided to descend on many different cities around the country, it is certainly imperative on the left, isn't it, to have a strategy in place for how to confront this. And a lot of people on the left feel like strategizing only gives them more attention, and that we should be working on the bigger and more important issues at hand, such as a fight for healthcare. So what is your response to that approach from the left, saying, don't pay them any heed, try to ignore them, don't show up and counter protest?
My immediate response to them is, you've never actually dealt with real Nazis before, have you? You know, anyone who, from people in the punk rock scene, from people who grew up where I am, to people who where I grew up, and to people who have dealt with Nazis during the Minuteman protests in 2006, know that when Nazis show up to your space, there's only one thing that they're there to do, and there's only one thing left to do, which is defend yourself. Calling attention to the systematic nature of these fascist rallies and firing campaigns on college campuses is an absolute priority. And, you know, it's not an either or issue when it comes to healthcare or, you know, redistribution or, you know, preserving the social safety net. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. The removal of the safety net and the economic insecurity that has gripped this nation and has gripped a whole generation of young people has, you know, made people vulnerable to the national socialist rhetoric of the fascist right, just as much as it has opened people up to the democratic alternatives that the left and, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement and the Green Party and all kinds of people have been trying to pursue as well. What I have been saying on social media is that, you know, in the collapse of the neoliberal system and the neoliberal center, what we are engaged in is we are in a race against neo-fascists for the mass organization of society and the basically the promotion of an alternative to the system that is killing us all, literally. So, you know, the best antidote to the fascist push, you know, in our society is, in fact, solidarity. And solidarity with people who are targeted, the lifting up of the free speech of people who are targeted, putting the defense of communities first is, you know, it's not incompatible with all of these other issues. It is part and parcel of them. And, you know, what I say to people is that if you don't want to, you know, have to deal with quote unquote violent confrontation, and we can get into what that actually means later. You know, if you don't like the tactics that are being used right now against fascists, then it's your job to show up. It is your job to speak out against this. It is your job to show up for communities, because if you do not and you turn your backs and you are silent, you are contributing to the problem. This is literally the moment where Audre Lorde's words, you know, resound more than ever, your silence will not protect us. It's where Howard Zinn's words will resound more than ever. You cannot be neutral on a moving train. This train has left the station, and now it's up to all of us to stand up for each other.
Melissa, what is Antifa? A-N-T-I-F-A. It is a name, it's a phrase, a framework that is being tossed around. We see it popping up in media and social media. The fascists know who they are. But tell us, in your words, to explain to people who are not familiar with what Antifa is.
Antifa, A-N-T-I-F-A, literally stands for anti-fascist. Anti-fascists have been around as long as fascists have. You know, the the symbol with the two flags, the red and the black flag, of anti-fascist action that many people may have seen around social media and at rallies, goes all the way back to 1932 in Germany, when the black shirts were beating up Jews in the streets, taking them away, and communities were organizing by themselves to basically, you know, confront the fascists in the streets. It is a tradition that goes back to the Spanish Civil War and the Abraham Lincoln brigades of socialists who went to Spain to fight against Franco and his forces. It goes back to the Battaglioni Arditi del Popolo in Italy, the Italian partisans that fought against Mussolini. To people who say this, you know, is just an internet meme, or this would just happen yesterday, or even people who say that these people are paid agents, that's honestly not true. Anti-fascists have been around for a very long time, and they have been part of our movements for a very long time. Some people will have a tactical disagreement because some of these groups do believe in property destruction, and also defending people bodily with fighting back. But if you take a longer historical view of these traditions, you will see that actually history was on their side. And even here in the United States, the people who went to Spain and the Abraham Lincoln brigades were derided by corporate media, well, back then, and the authorities, as and later called by people who, you know, historians, as premature anti-fascists. And so again, there is no equivalence between fascists and anti-fascists. There is one side, the fascists, is an ideology literally self-identified by their hatred and genocide and the denial of certain groups' right to exist. On the other side are the people who oppose that and are actually trying to put their bodies on the line to protect communities.
So Melissa, one of the people who has been captured in photos as marching in Charlottesville wants to say he is not a racist, that in fact what he is upset about is the erasure of white identity, if you will, that he said, I came to this march for the message that white European culture has a right to be here just like every other culture. It's not perfect. There are flaws to it, of course. However, I do believe the replacement of the statue, which is the Confederate Robert E. Lee statue, will be the slow replacement of white heritage within the United States. Basically, this idea that he is simply defending the white culture because it is being erased, and that he's not a racist. He does consider the term racist an insulting term, and one that he doesn't want to be associated with, which is just bizarre. How do you explain his statements?
Again, this is where, you know, putting things in historical context is really, really important. Let's look at the construction of the white identity in the first place. First of all, the construction of white identity is not a European artifact. It is an American artifact. It came out of Bacon's Rebellion in the late 1600s, which was an uprising that included enslaved Africans, indentured European servants, and indigenous peoples against their masters. In response, the masters took the Europeans, the poor Europeans, and started giving them jobs, started giving them little privileges like, access to certain resources, to jobs like slave catchers, which later became the institution of the police, which gave them overseeing jobs. Other ways in which white identity was literally constructed as a way to divide people based on the way they looked, their heritage, and their skin color. Like, it's actually, if this guy wants to preserve European culture, he actually should erase his white identity, because white identities erased and assimilated colonized European cultures like the Irish, like the Scottish, like the Eastern Europeans, in order to create a homogeneous racial identity that it's based literally on giving people privileges at the expense of others.
And honestly, if you just look at the statistics of who holds power today, there is not even in the slightest inkling that white men, which is what this group is primarily formed of, are losing power in any way. And by the way, Melissa, I want to just announce for you and our audience that on Monday, while you and I are talking, Donald Trump has finally caved into the pressure from his own party and simply came out and said, racism is evil. I mean, he literally said the term, racism is evil. This is what Trump said in a press conference on Monday. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. So this is breaking while you and I talk. I'm not sure how the Daily Stormer will respond, particularly since the Daily Stormer's hosting service, GoDaddy, has announced that it will be shutting down the server that GoDaddy gave Daily Stormer 24 hours to move their website. So I'm not sure how they see Donald Trump finally naming them and denouncing them. What are your thoughts?
Well, what Donald Trump's statements today, I'm not going to credit him with that. I'm going to credit the wave of support and solidarity and outrage in the wake of Charlottesville. I'm going to credit all of you listening and watching now. I'm going to credit people that I never saw before who were silent, who are now speaking up. That is the pressure that has actually caused Donald Trump to make his statements more explicit in terms of denouncing white supremacy. Although, what I would say to Donald Trump now is, you know what, now you have talked the talk, now it's time for you to walk the walk. It's time for you to disown Steve Bannon. It's time for you to disown Sebastian Gorka, who is a card-carrying member of the Hungarian Nazi Party affiliates. It's time for you to denounce all of the people in your administration who are connected with the KKK, white supremacists, and fascist organizations. Kick them all out. If you really mean what you say.
So finally, Melissa, I want to ask you about the work that you've been doing, particularly at a time when younger Americans, kind of disgusted by what they were seeing in places like Charlottesville, are looking to become engaged, organized, and are looking for a way to get involved. You have been engaged in a movement school for revolutionaries that you're teaching with David Cobb, coming soon to Los Angeles, where our LA audience might be able to check it out. Tell us about this movement school and what are the kinds of things that you hope to teach your students?
So the Movement School for Revolutionaries is a day-long custom designed workshop for various progressive groups, coalition groups, Green Party groups, and others that we have been doing throughout the country that is basically based on four modules. One is the what we call the big picture or the meta context, like delving into the legacies of patriarchy, imperialism, white supremacy, and capitalism, and how they sort of work through us in our society and in our organizing spaces. Our second module is kind of a history lesson, again, putting the current situation in historical context, just like I've been kind of going into in this interview. Number three is what we call the analytical toolbox for revolutionaries, which is some theoretical concepts and ideas that that we think are very essential to organizing in this moment. And number four is a strategic planning session where we talk to people in their local context and, not tell them what to do, but rather to facilitate some locally determined decision making as to actual strategic organizing projects that these groups can engage in. It is based on sort of a tactic that was pursued in the 1920s and later abandoned, called the United Front, where people were engaged in a whole generation of socialist revolutionaries in Europe, from Rosa Luxemburg to Lenin to Trotsky to Antonio Gramsci in Italy, that was basically focused on how do we unite the left Not compromising our principles to reformists, but rather uniting people against fascism, so that you know the an alternative and an actual program that places people at and people at the center. You know what we call what we say in the Green Party: people, planet, and peace over profit is essential for. Making convincing the masses of people not to go to fascism, but to actually fight for a better alternative. We've done 8 workshops so far, and we have many, many more lined up across the nation. So if you're interested, please let us know, and we'll be happy to come to your town and do a movement school for your group as well.
And we'll post information about the movement school on our website where people can get more information. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Melissa Figueroa is a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley and the press director for the Stein Baraka 2006 Green Party presidential campaign. She's the executive producer of the Green News Network, also part of the newly forming Campus Anti-Fascist Network. She's also a correspondent for this show. We've been discussing how to understand and respond to the Charlottesville violence. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.